Welcome back. When one reviewer calls Andrea Dworkin the most misrepresented writer in the Western world, we have to wonder what she's really saying and what they're saying about her. Her many books include Right-Wing Women, Pornography and Civil Rights, On the Continuing War Against Women, and Scapegoat, The Jews, Israel, and Women's Liberation. She readily admits difficulty at compromising, whether with obvious foes or supposed allies. In her latest book, the subject is herself. It's called Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. If you want to talk to her, we'll take your calls a bit later at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372 or gms at kera.org. Welcome.
Hello.
Several of the early essays in this collection are about music and your changing early tastes, and especially Bessie Smith. What drew you to Bessie Smith?
Partly her stance, the fact that she never seemed to compromise in the music that she made, that her lyrics and her way of presenting them were just, they were winter, or like they were summer, or they were fall, or they were spring. I mean, they just were what they were, and there was no stupidity or silliness to them. It wasn't show business. Instead, it was some kind of really, really deep passion. I loved her. I really loved her.
You said, I like this line. You said that a U.S. writer without jazz and blues in her veins must have ice water instead. What other stuff did you listen to?
Well, I listened to white blues singers like Dave Van Ronk. And I listened to Billie Holiday a lot. I listened to Miles Davis and John Coltrane and a lot of blues men and jazz men. And the records weren't that easy to find where I lived. It wasn't like now where there's this tremendous renaissance because of CDs. You know, a lot of records that were just out of print you can now get, and it's been the most just remarkable renaissance of jazz in particular. So it wasn't like that back then, and I would go searching the used record bins along 8th Avenue in New York City and just try to find records I had never heard before.
When you started reading widely, were you looking for writers that wrote like those musicians played?
Very much so. I wanted writers who had just fierceness in their soul. I wanted writers who weren't afraid of anything. I wanted writers who could bring glory to the language. And I think I found some of them at any rate.
You had this. You wrote about the high school library, and I suppose reading generally. Why were those important to you when you were a kid?
Well, the high school library was the only place to get a lot of books. It was we were in school most of the day, so when you wanted to read something, about the only place to go to get a book was the high school library, and the librarians were very vigilant in keeping you from getting books. They seemed to think that their job was to guard the books from the students. And so I would go in. I mean, there weren't computers, so all of the records were kept by hand. And I would figure out the shifts of the librarians, and I would go in and I would get, I think the limit was 2 books per student, and so I'd get 2 books, and then the shift would change, and I'd get another 2 books and another 2 books, and till I got what I thought could get me through the night.
What did you read? What did you like?
I loved Darwin. To me, he wasn't a scientist. It was the journey of the H.M. Bigel was like going to Disneyland or something. I mean, it was just a phenomenal travelogue of things I had never seen. And that was what I liked most about reading. It was filled with things I had never seen, places I had never gone, people I had never known, and the only way to find those things were in books.
Andrea Dworkin's my guest. If you'd like to talk to her, we're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Her new book is called Heartbreak, the Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. Tell the story about David Smith, whom I had never heard of, and why it left an impression on you.
Well, David Smith was a sculptor, and at the time that I met him, which is when I was in college, he was probably the most famous sculptor in the United States, and probably to the rest of the world, he was the most famous U.S. sculptor. And he lectured at the school I went to one night, and a friend said she wanted to go meet him, and she said that would be all right, and I went with her. And we went to the house where he was staying, which was the house that Robert Frost had once lived in, and which then belonged to Kenneth Nolan, and who was a painter, a very fine painter. And so we went to this place, and when somebody spoke at Bennington, when a male spoke at Bennington, because nobody was inviting women to speak in those days, they would get the gift of a Bennington girl for the night. Somehow it always worked out that way. And so several of my classmates were there dressed in black sheaths and waiting for Mr. Smith, and the man who had invited him there, the sculptor Anthony Caro, who's a British sculptor. And Smith wasn't interested in them. And for some reason, he wanted to talk in particular to me. And he told me this story about having been on the phone with President Kennedy. And Smith had signed a petition in behalf of Cuba. And Kennedy told him that if he didn't take his name off the petition, he would never get the money that he had been promised to start a graduate school in sculpture at Bennington. And he had taken his name off of the petition. And he talked about the fact that he had whored, that he had become a whore in relation to this thing. And he told me never, ever to do that, because once you give up what you believe in, you don't ever get it back. So it was a very significant night of my life, and especially because he died a week and a half later. He crashed his motorcycle into a tree, the kind of death that is usually considered by police an act of suicide.
If you want to talk to Andrea Dworkin, we're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Can you remember when your ideas about what came to be, called under the general title feminism coalesced? I mean, was it a switch thrown and the light came on, or a more gradual process?
It happened late to me. It happened much earlier to many of my women friends and colleagues in the women's movement. I had always been active politically, but not in the women's movement. And I was living in Europe when the women's movement sort of took fire in the United States. And I became a feminist because I had been the wife of a very political man, and he was a batterer, and he battered me. And I tried to get away many times, and couldn't get away. And the only people who would help me were these women who called themselves feminists. And I thought they were very remarkable women. And I still think they were very remarkable women. And that's how I became a feminist. I mean, I listened to what they had to say. I read books that they recommended. I was very resistant. It took me a very long time to become a feminist. But at some moment, I realized that I really owed my life to the women's movement. And once I realized that, I made a pledge to myself and the woman who had helped me most, whose name was Ricky Abrams, that I would always work for women and that I would try to pay back the good that had been done for me.
Why did it take a long time? Why was there resistance on your part?
I was very involved in the kind of literature that Kate Millett pulled apart in Sexual Politics. The writers that I read were, I liked Henry Miller. I read Norma Mailer. The writers whose Sexual Politics she tore to pieces. And I couldn't wean myself away from those particular writers, and I was very involved in sexual liberation, which I think a lot of women then were. I took it very seriously, and so it was hard to take on feminism, because feminism was a challenge to everything that those writers stood for and to everything that sexual liberation stood for.
You knew a lot of people, one of whom, who doesn't come across all that well in your essay, is Allen Ginsberg. Did your mind change about him over time?
Well, I adored him when I was a teenager, and I loved his poetry, and I just thought he was, like the best in the world as a poet. And my mind did change very much about him. We became godparents of the same child. And at that child's bar mitzvah, Alan sort of wouldn't leave me alone. And he was very aggressive about the fact that he was a pedophile. Most people take that as a metaphor. It wasn't a metaphor. It was the truth. He was a pedophile. He aggressively chased children to have sex with them. That's what he did. And I found it reprehensible. And I found him reprehensible for doing it.
Andrea Dworkin's my guest. We're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Her new book is called Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. We'll start taking some calls after the break. We can also reach us at gms@kera.com. Welcome back. Andrea Dworkin's my guest. Her new book is a memoir, Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. Do you think being a big reader made it easier for you or natural for you to become a writer?
Could you say that again?
Sure. I mean, you were a big reader as a kid. Do you think that that made it easier for you to become a writer or made it more natural that you would become a writer?
I think it was the world I wanted to live in. Reading set out the boundaries for me of the world I wanted to live in. And I don't think that necessarily means that I would have become a writer, but I just had this heartbeat that just wanted to write. There was nothing else that I could think of that I really wanted to do, except sometimes I had a very deep interest in becoming a lawyer, and that's because I had a very Perry Mason-ish idea of what a lawyer was. And so I thought that I was very involved with caring about abortion rights, and which I got from my mother. And I thought there must be two ways of getting at the abortion right for women. The first was that you were a writer and you wrote a book that was so wonderful that people would, understand why women needed the abortion right. And the second was that you became a lawyer and you gave such an incredible argument in a court of law that the laws changed. So at some point I realized that people could stop me from being a lawyer, but they couldn't stop me from being a writer. And so I was going to become a writer.
It sounds as if you had quite an adventure for a while, basically going off to Crete and learning how to write. Why Crete? What drew you to that place?
Well, there were two places at the time that were that were cheap that people like myself could go to. One was Spain, but it was still under Franco, and one was Greece. And so I decided to go to Greece. And while I was in Athens, I met a woman at the Y where I was staying who came from Crete, and she recommended that I go there. And I did, and I loved it. It was so beautiful and so wonderful, and I liked the people so much. So I stayed there for quite a while.
And wrote a lot?
I did. I started getting serious about writing. I started trying to teach myself how to write. And so every day I would write. Every afternoon I would do two things. I would try to learn Greek from a very old grammar book that I had found, and I would try to write.
What were you writing?
I was writing exceptionally imitative pieces of work by Jean Genet. I really was imitating the writers that I liked the best, and I was writing plays and dialogues, and there was nothing original about them, but I learned something about the discipline of writing, something about the fact that when you start writing, you have to keep going, because it's not something that you can do piecemeal, and it's not something that you can do just now and then or as an amateur. It's something that you have to do all the time and that you have to devote yourself to.
Was there a point at which you were conscious of the fact that you were no longer mimicking or copying, that you said to yourself, boy, I'm writing original stuff now?
It didn't happen that way. When I became a feminist, I had came back to New York from Amsterdam, and I was living on the Lower East Side, and I was exceptionally poor, and I was still trying to write, only my subject matter had changed very much, and I wrote for women. I wrote in behalf of women, and that was different. That was different than anything I had done before, and so I kept doing it and kept getting deeper and deeper with it.
If you'd like to talk to Andrea Dworkin, we'll take your calls at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Her new book is called Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. Carl, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
Ms. Dworkin, I was wondering if I might ask you just a brief question. I was interested in your thoughts on men being feminists. I went to seminary briefly, a Baptist one, and actually had a somewhat feminist awakening there. But some people have said men can't be feminist. Others have said, but of course they can. So I was just curious on your thoughts, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's a good question. I think men can be feminists. I think feminism is a series of principles and a series of practices, and that it's not a biological frame of mind. It doesn't have to do with being born one way or another way. But what's hard for men about feminism is that women have most of the brutal experiences at the hands of men. Men have some of them, but women have a lot of them. And so men have to figure out a way to listen to women and to listen to what women's experiences are as a part of the feminism that they practice. And I think that that's probably very difficult.
Again, we're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372 or gms@kera.org if you have a question for Andrea Dworkin. You went back to Bennington this would have been, I guess, late 60s.
Yes.
Scraps over Vietnam, legalized abortion, even over contraception. And yet you say the biggest issue on campus was boys in girls' dorm rooms, which,
right,
you know, 30 years plus sounds almost quaint. Why was it a big deal?
It's so funny now that men and women live in the same houses. It's something you couldn't have imagined when I went to college. And a lot of the energy of college administrators had to do with keeping men and women separate on college campuses, especially at night. And those of us who went to Bennington had a lot of freedom, I guess you would call it. There were only 4 hours during which men couldn't be in women's rooms, and I think it was 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And it was one of those issues that became the symbol for a lot of other issues, for the fact that Bennington was a school where you could learn what you wanted to learn, and the new president of the school was trying to make it a very conventional and conformist school, and a lot of us didn't like that. So the parietal hours, as they are called, were symbolic of the desire of this new president to kind of clamp down on what women were doing and make sure women followed rules. And the fact that the women didn't want to follow his rules, and we rebelled, and the symbolic thing that we rebelled about were parietal hours.
And won?
Excuse me?
Did you prevail, or?
Well, I guess we didn't prevail in the sense that what we did was I was elected to the Judiciary Committee because people felt that I wasn't afraid of the president, which is true. I wasn't afraid of him. And what we did was ask the students to write letters to us on the Judiciary Committee saying that they had broken that rule. And there were about 400 students. About 6 of them didn't write the letters, but everybody else did. And we expelled every one of them. We had told them we would expel them, and we did expel them. And so suddenly there was no school. And it was quite a shock to the faculty and to the administration that they actually needed students in order to have a school. And I thought it was a really good action. I liked it a lot. But what the president did was to wait until the end of the year and students went home, and then he wrote to their parents and basically said that they wouldn't be allowed back into school if they didn't sign a loyalty oath to the Constitution of the college. Now, what the Judiciary Committee had done was to follow the Constitution, absolutely. But he decided that he was going to make everybody sign these little loyalty oaths. So I didn't sign it, and I didn't go back. And a lot of people did sign it, and they went back.
You realized pretty early on that you were not a conservative, and yet there was something about them that interested you. You started reading National Review. I think you said in one of the articles that you still do. How come?
Yeah, I'm not really quite sure. Two of the best teachers that I had, one in junior high and one in high school, were political conservatives. And I couldn't understand what made them different from me, or why, you know, my father thought one way about things and they thought another way about them. And so I was just interested in them intellectually and wanted to figure out how they had arrived at the positions they had arrived at.
Tell me some more about your parents.
My father was a teacher who then became a guidance counselor. And he also worked in the post office lifting heavy packages into trucks. My mother was ill most of my life. She had heart disease. And my father worked very hard to keep her with medical care, good medical care. And my brother and I stayed with different relatives at different times. We often didn't know where the other one was. So it was kind of living a little bit like an orphan, and at the same time with a great deal of anxiety about my mother's health. And, you know, it wasn't really easy. It was hard.
If you want to talk to us today, 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Andrea Dworkin's my guest. Her new book is called Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. Dan in Fort Worth, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a short question, I guess. Since the women's movement, there has been some social disorder in giving rights to women, and I am, I don't know if there's a male feminist, and that last caller commented on that, but if there is one, I'm one. But there has been some social disorder as far as divorce rates and as far as women's realizing or coming into their own rights. If that is good, what is, do you think the women's movement can do to rectify it or bring a new order to our familial lives?
Well, I think that we don't understand a lot that change is actually very slow. Most of us, including myself, are very impatient with change. And so that you see, at least I feel that I'm looking at a kind of, women going back into the house after we fought so hard for women to be able to be out of the house. And I think that that'll change again, and that men will have to take on part of their role in taking care of children, which now they're not particularly doing, and taking care of the house, which now they're not particularly doing. And, I think things will change back again. But it's very hard to really make social change, and people get incredibly tired of working to do that. And I think that feminists have gotten incredibly tired of working for social change, and that's a lot of what we're seeing when it comes to reforming divorce laws and reforming, the way we take care of children, those kinds of things.
Were you fighting for women's ability to be out of the house or women's ability to be able to decide what they wanted to do without restriction?
Well, for me, I was fighting in ways that had to do with fighting violence against women. That was the area in which I felt I had something to contribute. And I didn't ever think it would be as big an issue as, in fact, it has become, because I didn't know that the violence was as vast as it is. And, you know, I'd say the one thing that feminists haven't backed down on is violence against women, and that standing up for it is really very, very hard. And, you know, we have got to deal with rape. We have got to deal with battery. We have got to deal with prostitution. We have got to deal with pornography. And all of those things are difficult to deal with. And we're ostracized when we do try to do something about them. And then people get upset that they're being ostracized. So what I did was work on something that a lot of people didn't think was very important. And I did think it was important. And I've been very glad in the last 20 years to see that growing numbers of women have thought it's important.
Fairly early on, you saw something of a split forming between feminists and at least some people on the political left. How come? I would have figured that that would have been, those groups would have been more naturally allied.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it started quite early on because the left was really the counterculture left, or the new left, as we called it then. And they were, the men in the new left were quite determined that the women in the new left were going to sort of serve them and be servile to them. And feminism really grew out of women's rebellion against leftist men demanding that women, you know, do the cooking and go into bed three at a time. And again, it was very tied up with sexual liberation much more than with anything else. And so as women grew more and more rebellious, women separated more and more from men on the left.
Andrea Dworkin's my guest. Her new book is called Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Militant, or a Feminist Militant. We have some folks holding to talk. We'll get to them as soon as we get back. If you want to join them, we're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-537. I neglected to mention that in the other hour tomorrow, we'll talk with the winners of the Rising Star Chefs competition and one of the wine judges who took part in the Dallas Wine and Food Festival. Andrea Dworkin, my guest this hour. We're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. Her new book is called Heartbreak, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. You've written a lot about pornography and prostitution, and in one of these essays, you say the world gets meaner as prostitution and pornography are legitimized. Why?
Because they're both practices of cruelty. They both exploit women and very often children, and they both have to do with making certain that women and children who are involved in pornography and prostitution have no right to a full life and a good life. And I think that there's been a lot of effort in the United States to make both pornography and prostitution legitimate, just legitimate, that they're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. They're okay. And they're incredibly hurtful. They hurt women and children in horrible ways. And women and children don't recover from the ways in which they're hurt by them. So that's why I say that.
I don't know if this applies to prostitution, but where pornography is concerned, is this one of the areas where feminism and the political left get crossways, because some people on the left defend pornography as a First Amendment issue?
Well, I don't think that the First Amendment is particularly a leftist issue. I think anybody defending pornography will use the First Amendment to do it because it's easy to do. It's easy to use it. The question of who are those women in the pictures is the First Amendment question that needs answering. Who are those women and how did they get there? And where are they going from that picture? What are their lives like? Who are they? Where did they come from? Those are all questions that need to be answered. And when you pull the First Amendment in front of pornography, what you do is stop people from asking and answering those questions.
Let's get some calls. We're at 214-871-9010 or 1-800-933-5372. John in Richardson. Hi.
Yes. Well, I'd like to ask about the connection between sexual liberation and the women's movement, too. And isn't the problem that the sexual movement has been a men's thing, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be sexual liberation for women. It just means it needs to be on their own terms, that they need their own sexual independence to go along with economic and political independence. It would just look very different, maybe, from what has been put out there from the left. Or
okay, we'll ask. We'll ask. John, thanks.
Well, I think that that's right. It would look very different. But you have to deal with the issue of power and the kind of power that men have over women, and especially the kind of power that men express in sex with women. And so I think that it's not good enough to say that women would have their own sexual liberation and men have their sexual liberation. I think that women tried to do that for quite a while, and it didn't work. And one of the reasons that it didn't work was that men refused to give up any of the power that they had.
To Richard in Irving. Hi.
Hi. I got a quick question. I'll take my answer off the air. I'm looking back in history, just thinking in my mind about how some of the men in politics treated women, like Bob Packwood, Clarence Thomas, Bill Clinton, and Teddy Kennedy. And it seems to me that the feminist reaction to Mr. Clinton's treatment of women, Mr. Kennedy's treatment of women, and even the way O.J. Simpson treated his wife seemed to be less vigorous than the way they reacted to the Thomas Bob Packwood issues. And also, do you think Hillary Clinton, the feminist movement, a disservice by standing by him while he behaved in such a way? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thanks.
I do think that Hillary Clinton did the women's movement a disservice by standing by her man, and especially with respect to Juanita Broderick and her assertion that she was raped by Bill Clinton. I think that, you know, we haven't heard anything more about it since the charge was made. And I think it's a righteous charge. And, I think Hillary hurt us all when she simply refused to take any responsibility for what Bill might or might not have done. And I didn't get the first part of the question.
That's okay. How do you explain the backlash against feminism from young women?
Feminism is hard to do. It's something that you have to feel deeply. And there are a lot of women, young women, who feel feminism very deeply and who have a passion for feminism. There are probably as many who just want to be left alone to do what they want to do, and they don't really want these older women bothering them with, with what we think is important. And I think the conflict is fine. I don't have any problem with it. I think that if younger women have conflict with older women about what feminism is, then we should just have the conflict.
Let's go to Elaine in Flower Mound. Hi.
Hi, Ms. Dworkin. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you.
Do you feel that feminism is regressing when sexism becomes blunt? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
When sexism becomes what?
I didn't catch it either. Maybe she can call back. Do that.
Carol, if you could call back.
Yeah, call back.
The end of that.
We didn't quite catch the end of your question. In the meantime, we'll talk to John in Dallas. Hi.
Yes, from the very beginning of feminism with the Lesbian Liberation Front and the Daughters of Bilitis and everything, lesbians have had a great role in feminism, especially, of course, in New York City. I wonder if that isn't turning off today's young female. And I'll listen to your answer.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, actually, Daughters of Bilitis and other lesbian groups happened before feminism did. They're older than feminism, or certainly than this wave of feminism. And sometimes they're not feminist. Sometimes they're anti-feminist. And yet the women's movement provided enormous vigor for lesbians and lesbians who wanted to be political in a feminist way. So I think you just have to understand that the lesbian movement and the women's movement aren't necessarily the same thing, and that sometimes there's been really a lot of conflict, and that the lesbian movement is older than the women's movement.
To Candace in Dallas. Hi.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I have a couple of points that kind of go together. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I'm 33 years old. I always considered myself to be a feminist and had a difficult time deciding to stay at home and leaving my career, which I went to graduate school to do. And I wanted to say that it's been interesting, my experience, because I have lots of friends who chose not to quit work. And I do plan to go back to work, but it's interesting the way that feminism causes conflict between some of the women that I encounter, how some of them, because they chose to stay at work, maybe perhaps think that I made a bad choice, or maybe perhaps feel that I may think that they made a bad choice by staying at work. And I'm just surprised that women have not evolved to the state that we can each respect the other's choices.
Okay.
One more thing.
We're short on time. Let's get a response to that part. Thanks.
Well, I think that that your observation is a really good one, and I think women are so used to being judged that being judged by other women is just something that seems natural. The fact of the matter is you made your choice and nobody's got a right to judge you about it. And the same for women who made a different choice. Now, that's not true of everything. There are things that people have a right to judge other people for, things that are incredibly hurtful or distressing or devastating. But I don't think that staying at home or not staying at home is one of those things.
I mentioned the subtitle of your book, The Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant, which, you know, that's perfectly straightforward. Why heartbreak?
Well, because if you are in a political movement, you have a lot of wins, you know, you have a lot of victories, but you also have a lot of losses, and the losses are very hard to take. So they really, at least for me, they really have broken my heart. And I decided not to be coy about it.
I think we've reestablished contact with Elaine. Hi there.
Hi. Sorry about that. Okay, is feminism regressing when sexism seems to become more blunt in society?
Oh, okay.
And I'll hold.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure that feminism is regressing, but I think that feminism has a harder and harder time as sexism becomes more blunt in society, or when you see Hugh Hefner running around in his pajamas, or, you know, whatever the incarnation of sexism is at a given moment. And that's why I think that the existence of pornography and the legitimizing of it is so important, because it's the direct opposite of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And we want one or the other. We can't have both.
Elaine, thanks for calling back.
Thank you. Bye.
Let's get a call from Jay in Arlington. Hi.
Yeah, if feminism is about empowering women and allowing them to make their choices, why is, if prostitution was legal, why does that go against feminism? Like in Holland, for example, prostitution is legal and women probably have better status than in other countries where it's illegal.
Thanks.
Okay, I lived in Holland for 5 years, and the prostituted women in Amsterdam have the highest rate of mortality in the country. People live a very long time in Holland, but the prostitutes don't. And I think that when you say that for women, prostitution is kind of the main choice, the kind of the choice that gives women what women might want, you're misunderstanding the nature of prostitution. In Holland and in several other countries, the lives of prostitutes are not as degraded as they are here, but they are still degraded, and women are still humiliated by prostitution. So, I think it's still a completely alienated way of life. And when I was there maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I went back for a while to see a few things. And one of the things I saw was that the streets in the prostitute area of Amsterdam were filled with 12 and 13 and 14-year-old children who were prostituting. And that's a different picture than most people give of Amsterdam and prostitution.
Andrea, we're about out of time. How are you feeling these days?
Oh, I'm pretty tired. But I'm okay.
I read that you had some work on your knees.
Yeah, I had arthritis in my knees, so I had two knee replacements.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's extremely painful.
Well, Take it easy and just stick with phone interviews.
Thank you.
Don't go out on the road. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Just hang on the line for 1 second there. Andrea Dworkin's new book is called Heartbreak, the Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. It's published by Basic Books. Quick break. We'll be right back.